Today is Wednesday, March 18th. I call this meeting of the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee to order. Representative Clark moves approval of the minutes dated March 17th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted.
They got to get you where they can.
Members, we have five bills on the agenda today, but only Representative Vogel is here, so attendance being prompt and on time, he gets to go first. Representative Vogel moves that House, or Representative Vogel, to your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 1105.
Representative Vogel moves House File 1105 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and there's also an author's amendment.
We did not have a author's amendment in the packet, Representative Vogel.
We didn't.
Representative Vogel, why don't you go ahead with your presentation, and we'll see what the amendment situation
sure.
is.
Well, first of all, recognizing that this is the first time that I'm in front of my own committee, I did bring treats because I wouldn't want to be accused of not doing the proper thing.
Representative Mahoney votes aye.
And the treats are from they're Klotzky. And they're representative of the district. New Prague has got a heavy check population as well as some of the other areas. So I thought we'll have some native food. So maybe if the somebody could pass it out, they're over there.
Representative Vogel.
Yeah, and you know, if we get them done before somebody gets here.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we'll see what we can do with the amendment. What this does is basically three things, and it expands the eligibility for the Urban Initiative Loan Program to the entire seven-county metro area. Originally, the program was set out to serve just Minneapolis and St. Paul, and in 2005 was expanded to other specific low-income communities. So what it will now do is expand the reach to the entire seven-county metro area, but it doesn't change the emphasis on low-income and minority businesses. It also does change, however, the eligibility from a low-income area to a low-income person, so therefore allowing it to reach more people. Potentially clients who could create jobs, maybe even bakery jobs. Second, it adds an additional $1 million over the 16-17 biennium for the loan program, the Urban Initiative Loan Program. And third, it increases the funding for the Technical Assistance Program by $700,000 over the biennium. And that amount will be used to support business development pilot programs, which consult with startup and small business to provide management and planning services. And with that, first of all, the guest on my right is my good housekeeping mentor for my office, granddaughter Michaela. So it's nice to have her here today. She won't be testifying, but...
Why not?
Would you like her to introduce herself for the committee?
Representative Vogel, do you have any invited testifiers? Did you wish to speak?
You want to introduce yourself?
I'm Kayla, and I'm from Prior Lake.
Well, nice to meet you. Welcome to our committee.
And I do have two testifiers, Lee Hall from the MCCD and John Sullivan from the Carver CDA. So I'll turn it over to them for some of the details, if unless you wanted to have questions of me first.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Lee Hall. I'm the Director of Finance for the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers.
Good afternoon, Commissioner and members of the committee. I'm John Sullivan. I'm the Economic Development Director for Carver County.
Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, representatives, MCCD, the Metropolitan Consortium, has been a sub-allocatee of the Urban Initiatives Program since the mid-90s. The program was created in the mid-90s as a mirror program to the Greater Minnesota Initiative Fund, which provided startup capital and support to entrepreneurs and small business ventures in outstate Minnesota. Urban Initiatives was introduced to provide similar support for struggling entrepreneurs, starting entrepreneurs, entrepreneurs that needed a little bit of extra help in distressed communities. At the time the bill was originally introduced, the distressed communities was defined as basically the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Obviously, a lot has changed in the metro area since 1995. The demographics have certainly changed. We're seeing greater diversity. We're seeing income levels of a lot of different stratas of income spread across the metro area. The program was amended in 2005 to allow some additional communities, primarily first-ring suburban communities where pockets of low income existed, to be eligible for the program. What we're proposing with this bill is expanding eligibility to the full seven-county metro to allow us to work with individuals who fall below 80% of the AMI who are looking to start a business or are in business and looking for some support. The importance of the program, this capital really serves as an important leverage tool. It lets us work with businesses that where we have a passionate entrepreneur, where there's really an opportunity for growth and expansion, but maybe they're not in a position where they're really able to directly access private capital at this stage of their business. It's not a replacement for private financing. It's not a replacement for the banks. It's an enhancement tool. I want to give one story of a UIP business that I was able to help in the last couple of years. When we talk about urban initiatives, when we were talking to Representative Vogel about our hopes with this bill, we were talking about what we identified as the service donut in the metro area. The outstate initiative programs covered everything outside of the seven-county metro. The urban initiatives program really specifically helped the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul communities right around that. And so what that really left was a service donut, everything between those core cities and where the initiative foundations met. This support wasn't really available to help those businesses. Speaking of donuts, I worked with a client maybe some of you have heard of a couple years ago. There's a business in Minneapolis known as Glam Doll Donuts. A couple of really bright, passionate entrepreneurs came to us a couple of years ago. They had a vision and they had an idea for a business that they wanted to start, but they were having a hard time accessing the capital through their bank. They needed about $120,000 to get the business going. The business really, it's a startup business and it really lacked collateral. There are a lot of soft costs in the startup. Their bank wasn't really comfortable approaching it at that level. So they referred the client to us. I worked with the client for about 6 months on some business planning issues, developing the projections, really refining the vision. We were able to put together a small financing piece to leverage bank financing. That $120,000, $90,000 of it came from a banking partner, $30,000 of it came from our organization, $15,000 of which came from the Urban Initiatives Program. So really just 10% of the total financing allowed us to leverage the total package, which created a business that's now receiving national press. They've been invited to be on a cooking show on the Food Network. They're getting publication across the country as a place to see when you visit the Twin Cities. They're employing a dozen FTEs now, paying an average wage of around $14 an hour, and really just with $15,000 of Urban Initiatives funds. And that's pretty common of what we see with these funds. We have about a $5 million total capital pool for the activity that we do. About $500,000 of that really comes from these Urban Initiatives funds. So this little bit of money that the state puts in becomes sort of that first layer of capital, which allows us to leverage other outside resources. We're able to bring in investments from foundations, investments from commercial banks that we can layer and make available to entrepreneurs. So really about 10% of our total portfolio comes from these funds and lets us bring the rest of those dollars in. Where we're challenged is when we're working with communities outside of those core neighborhoods, trying to help those entrepreneurs access that capital. I brought John Sullivan from Carver County. Carver County is one of our partners in our program work. John and I work really closely on a lot of deals, and I'm going to let John talk a little bit about why the access to these funds is important outside of those core cities.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee, and Lee, thank you very much. This bill is important as a practitioner of economic development for Carver County. Lee had talked a little bit about that service donut, if you will. Our incomes overall in Carver County are fairly high, but to some degree that's a detriment to us because I can't tap into a lot of federal sources. We're not eligible for the Economic Development Administration funds. We're not eligible for the USDA Rural Development. But every day, we have entrepreneurs and people that want to start businesses that come in that are low income, that are eligible, and they want to tap into funding resources that we can't give them, that we don't have. One of the things that would really help with the passing of this bill would be we could leverage our existing dollars, as thin as they are, with this program, and we could help people that certainly meet the income requirements to be able to start their own businesses and be able to expand. So I think it's important to really consider this and to take a tough look at it. I've worked in this area for just in the south area, both in Scott and Carver counties for the last 14 years approximately, and one of the reasons we've partnered with MCCD is we couldn't get any type of money to help people to start businesses. We just weren't eligible, so that's why we brought the MCCD in a couple years ago to help us with starting entrepreneurs. And their programs have really helped us leverage the existing dollars that we have. So I guess that with that, thank you, and I'll turn it back to Lee.
Thank you. Representative Vogel, do you have any other invited testifiers?
I do not.
Members, this is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this bill, and we'll move to the member questions or comments. Before we do that, Representative Mahoney, let me explain what happened with this amendment. The amendment was given to us, but I did not approve it in time, and I did not get copies to the committee. That's my fault. I'm inclined to waive the 24-hour rule on it, even though it wasn't posted, if that's okay with you.
Mr. Chair, I met with some of the advocates for the bill and was fully aware that something like this was coming. I think it's just fine, and it does mention the competitive grants, which are near and dear to my heart. So it's a good idea.
Representative Vogel, then, do you have a motion to make?
Yes, I would move the amendment A15-0081, simply clarifying the totals that will be allocated.
Thank you. With that, any questions, discussion? Seeing none, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm just trying to understand where are we increasing the amount of funds that are available? And I guess I'm wondering, having represented those areas where we have concentrated poverty, and it is related to the original bill, this moves it into areas that not necessarily concentrated poverty, but an individual who is experiencing poverty. And I understand the need for that. I'm just wondering, I don't mean understand the need for change. I understand that there are individuals who need that sort of help. Are we adding to the overall pot in order to do that, or are we maintaining the same level? What is the intention of the author, I guess, in terms of this? And maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
If it's okay, Representative Vogel, I'm going to go to Ms. Newman, who will, because I think underlying substance of the bill, I think we'll come back to that later. But in terms of what the actual amendment does, is it okay if I go to Ms. Newman?
Certainly.
And she can walk us
Thank
through?
You.
Ms. Newman, will you please walk us through the A15-0081 amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, on page 2, line 13, it just specifies that it is to low-income persons in the low-income area. And then the substantive change in the funding is on page 3,
right.
And it takes it deletes paragraph A and inserts instead $1,750,000 each year are to the Business Development Competitive Grant Program. And Representative Vogel, the Business Development Competitive Grant Program is different than the Challenge Grant Program in your bill, so I just want to clarify that that's
yes.
The proper, okay. So, Mr. Chair, that is the amendment.
Thank you. Representative Clark, any additional questions on the amendment?
Well, I understand that when I look back on page 2, line 2.13, you're removing any priority for minority business enterprises. Is that what you mean to do? I'm asking the author.
Representative Clark, that's actually on the underlying bill. So the right now we're just on the amendment. I understand your question is on the underlying bill, but with regards to the amendment that's before us.
Oh, we're just talking about the amendment at this point.
That is correct.
Okay.
Is it okay if we adopt the amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like, and then we can come back to, I'll come right back to you then?
Sure.
Okay. Any additional questions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The bill is now in the form it would like. Representative Clark, you had a question?
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to understand, I guess, the broader question is, the first one was, are we adding to a pot or are we using the same amount of money and spreading it out more and eliminating minority preference or minority concentration and, you know, focus? The focus has changed, and I'm wondering if we're adding more money so that we can do that or if we're just continuing the same amount.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it is actually adding money to both things, both the loan program and also to the consulting program. I can have Mr. Lee possibly explain that, Mr. Hall, explain that maybe a little bit better if you need more clarification on exactly where that money might go.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chairman.
Representative Clark.
Yeah, I would like to know what the difference is. We'll start with that.
To Mr. Sullivan or Mr. Hall?
Mr. Chair, Representative, an urban initiatives program was originally capitalized with $6 million. It's had two small allocations added to it over time. Those funds are recycled in the program as loans are made. But at current time, I don't have the exact dollar amount available, but at current time, the funds available through the state that are unallocated is about $125,000 for the program as a whole. So what this bill is requesting is that $1 million of new money be added to that allocation, which would then also be opened up for use in these new communities. So the bill does both things. It adds funds to serve minority and low-income businesses outside of the current geographic area, but it's also adding additional resources so we can continue to serve businesses inside the geographic area.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, so if that's your intention, why are you eliminating the word minority on line 2.13?
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we didn't mean to eliminate it. It's actually incorporated later in the sentence. Just in clarity of reading the paragraph, we've removed minority after the word promote and moved it to job creation for minority and low-income persons through the 7 county. So the intention is to keep the focus on minority in there. It was a clerical choice to make the sentence read clearer.
Representative Clark, it does not remove minority. It's just
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I understand your reasoning because you didn't remove it the second time. That's good. Mr. Chairman, I'll just stop it there at that point for now.
Representative Wagenius.
On that, I think you do change the meaning of it when you're removing minority. So it's to promote minority business enterprises. So now it's just to promote business enterprises. But there's job creation for minority low-income persons. So it is a change in what we are doing. So it's not just a change in reading of the language. So we are taking away the emphasis on promoting minority business enterprises. And I would suggest that that's a major change it is a major change.
We heard from the testifier that was not the intent. Representative Vogel, if we can debate grammar for a while, or if you want, can we remove the stricken language in line 2.13, and does it still work fine?
I guess I would be fine with that.
It doesn't change anything.
I don't think it will change anything as far as the implementation. So,
all right.
If indeed that's an issue, I would have no problem with that.
Representative Mahoney, you okay with us doing this on the fly right now? Cool. So with that, Representative Vogel then moves that the language that is stricken on line 2.13, the word minority that's stricken, be unstricken. Is that the right way to do it, Ms. Newman?
Yeah, Mr.
All right,
Chair,
restored.
That's
Any discussion?
Thank
Seeing
you.
None, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. Any other questions from members of the committee? Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, you spoke to the Urban Initiative Board, and this is ripe for a nice amendment because the Urban Initiative Board is pretty much an all-Minneapolis board, and it serves 11 communities on the west side of the river and 12 on the east side of the river. Now, certainly the board doesn't get to choose who gets, as a board member, that's on the governor's issue, but just be aware of that, Representative Vogel, that there may be an amendment coming. But in any event, this is a really good move forward on this. I do understand, and I'm a geek in other ways than our chair, the demographics. There are low-income people throughout the 11 county. There's pockets of low-income communities throughout the 11 county metro area rather than just the 7 county metro area, but 7 county is an easier way for us to work. So, members, this is actually a really good bill. The $1.75 million, I certainly hope that this is something that the chair looks very, very favorably on. We did, last year, we did about $6 million to all the Greater Minnesota Initiative Foundations and $500,000 to the Urban Initiative Foundation. This is kind of catching it up. So hopefully we can get this through and into the big omnibus bill, or is this going to move on its own? Whichever, but this is a good bill, and I hope we can send it out of here with a really strong yes vote.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Any closing comments, Representative Vogel?
First of all, thank you for hearing it today. The program helps low-income and minority startup businesses to receive the mentoring that they need, some cases, and more importantly than the financial help. 40 years of experience in working with small businesses have taught me that most of the small business failures are caused not by a lack of management experience, more so than the symptom, which is a lot of times looked at as money able to be lent. So what they're doing here is really working with people and their dreams and trying to make that dream into a reality by giving them the experience that they have, or sharing the experience they have to get a business going and then to keep it going. Because sometimes the worst thing that can happen to a business is to have an initial success, because it drives their need for more capital and they don't have it because they haven't planned right. So I appreciate the support, and I think you're doing some really great things here for small business startups.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. With that, Representative Vogel renews his motion to have House File 1105 as amended laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Vogel, and our testifiers. Representative Dean. Representative Dean, do you have someone to move your bill?
I will move it.
Who said that? Okay, I looked over and I saw staff. I was like, you can't do that. What do you mean? Representative Scott moves that House File 1012 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the time today for your consideration of House File 1012. And what that does is it provides more choice for Minnesotans who are receiving services and want to live in a community-based home. And what we've done in the past is we've moved from institutionalized settings for care to community-based settings for care. And part of that was to cap the number of people living at any one place. In 2011, Representative Abler, realizing that there was a need for more flexibility in that, to be able to provide people places where they want to live, lifted a cap of 4 people per house to 25% per building. What that does is it allows for more flexibility so that people can live where they want to live. Representative Clark has been a supporter of this in the past, and as we're moving forward, we want to be able to provide people with more flexibility. I have Mr. Chuck Peterson from Coalition, who is here to discuss this a little bit further, and that's my only testifier, Mr. Chair, to explain the bill.
And before we go to you, Mr. Peterson, there is an A1 amendment in our packet. Is that yours, Representative Dean?
Oh, yep. I'm sorry. I'd like to move the A1 amendment to get it in the shape that I would like, and that just is a technical amendment that changes the effective date to July 1st, 2016.
Well, Representative Dean, you're not on this committee, so you can't move the amendment. Do you have an alternative strategy?
I would appreciate anyone in the committee moving the A1 amendment.
Cheryl moved the A1 amendment to a 1012 to put the bill in the form the author would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails.
However, if I were to be on another committee, I would choose this one.
And I would quickly choose a different one. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chuck Peterson, and I serve as Executive Director of Clare Housing and co-chair of the Coalition for Choice in Housing, which is a diverse coalition of tenants, advocates, individuals, and providers who believe that all Minnesotans with disabilities deserve meaningful choice in housing. I'm here to ask your support of House File 1012, which is a bill that completes 4 years of work on a very complex policy issue. It addresses an issue which our legislature, the federal government, and the courts have been struggling with for many years. Specifically, it strives to find a way to achieve two important imperatives of providing people with disabilities both meaningful choice for quality supportive housing as well as integration in the community. One of the central components of the current statute is that no more than 4 or 25% of tenants in a setting can receive certain home and community-based services. Despite the existing cap, over the past several years, Minnesota has allowed individual supporting housing projects to move forward, such as Touchstone's Rising Cedar Apartments for people living with mental illness and Clare Housing's Supportive Housing Apartments for people living with HIV. These exceptions were created because we know that this hard 25% statutory cap is a barrier to providing the kind of high-quality, supportive housing that people deserve and is needed in our community. Although the current statute was created with good intentions, it's fallen short for several reasons. First, it's been characterized as unlikely enforceable in its current form under fair housing law. Second, it was originally envisioned to apply to new settings only. We know that the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare will not allow any grandfathering or exceptions. And third, as previously mentioned, it's led to a patchwork of carve-outs over the last several years, which have passed partly because many people recognize that an entire range of settings are needed to help individuals best achieve their individual community living and wellness goals. We believe that House File 1012 builds upon the original intent of the current statute, and most importantly, it retains the concept of applying heightened scrutiny to the settings that exceed 25% and only allowing those with well-designed settings to move forward. Federal requirements identified by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services say that settings that have certain characteristics that could possibly lead to isolation must receive heightened scrutiny. The Department of Human Services, who will administer the new regulations, have already made the decision to include the 25% measure in the statewide transition plan as one characteristic of possible isolation. I'd like to ask you to support this bill because it recognizes the need to balance choice, quality, and integration while appreciating the significant role supportive housing plays in our community and the new federal and state regulations that will ensure that these values not just become an ideal, but an enforceable reality. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of our meeting and move to member questions. Member questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative Dean, any closing comments?
I just appreciate your time and your support.
With that, Representative Scott renews her motion to have House File 1012 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the HHS Finance Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dean.
Thank you for your time.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that, ask that we move File 713.
Representative Lunan moves that House File 713 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Lunan, do you have any amendments to your bill?
I do not.
Okay, Representative Lunan.
Mr. Chairman, members, this bill, we're coming to you today to help us take care of a symptom that was created by the success of a program created by the legislature in years past that had to do with internship programs and solving the problem for some of our young people who can't get a job because they don't have experience and can't get experience because they don't have a job. And I've got a testifier here today. I'm going to have a talk briefly about the program, but what we're looking for, the current funding level is $425,000 annually with the $850 per biennium, and we're asking to increase that because of the number of students we've had to turn away from this program, up to 900,000 the first fiscal year with 1.1 million the second fiscal year. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
John Dukic with the Minnesota High Tech Association.
And as Representative Lunan mentioned, this bill increases funding for the SciTech Experience Internship Program to $2 million over the next biennium, and that will provide for, or allow us to double the number of internships from 225 to 450. And what the SciTech Experience Internship Program does is provide students to give them the opportunity to take what they learn in the classroom and apply it to give them the on-the-job experience they need to land a career after they graduate from college. The program connects students to employers through a website, a web portal. Companies maintain hiring authority, and what we do at the High Tech Association is pre-screen student candidates as well as companies to make sure that they meet certain eligibility criteria. And as Representative Lunan mentioned, the $2 million funding at the $2 million level will allow us to greatly expand the program. Since the program's founding in 2012, we have funded nearly 300 internships at 131 different companies, and 2014 was the best year yet. With more than 600 student applicants, we had enough funding for only 117 internships. And these internships took place across the state, from Perham to Laverne to St. Cloud, Floodwood, and throughout the metro. And there should be a map in your packets showing where the internships took place. So this year, we have a goal of placing 125 interns, and as of Monday, we have 125 companies registered, 585 student applicants, which puts us nearly in line with where we were last year at the end of the year, and have already placed 49 interns. And as I mentioned, funding at the $2 million level will allow us to double the number of internships from 225 to 450. This is important because keeping talented students in Minnesota is critical for meeting our STEM workforce demands of today and tomorrow and supporting our growing entrepreneurial companies. And with your help, we can continue SciTech Experience as a way to prepare our students for entering the workforce. And we have with us today a couple of students, interns, and businesses who can share with you their experience with the program.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Kristen O'Connor, and I'm an analyst at Aspen Research Corporation.
Please continue with your testimony.
I was hired at Aspen as an intern during the summer of 2014, and I am still currently working at Aspen full-time. I heard about the program from one of my professors at College of St. Scholastica. He knew I was looking for work experience outside of school and gave me a flyer for the SciTech Experience program. I graduated from the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth with a bachelor's degree in chemistry. My internship at Aspen's analytical lab gave me the opportunity to get hands-on experience in an industrial lab setting versus an academic setting, further develop my skills in chemistry, as well as gaining critical lab and communication skills that cannot be taught in school, as well as understanding the business side of chemistry. At Aspen, I perform testing using a variety of analytical platforms, software, and instrumentation that also weren't available at my undergraduate institution. I improved my communication skills by working with project managers and clients individually, complying with employer and client confidentiality, and writing professional reports. Overall, this internship has helped me gain confidence in my abilities by handling expensive, irreplaceable, and time-sensitive samples for innovative projects. The most interesting project I've worked on so far is called Extractables and Leachables, and these are studies of plastic medical devices. Studies are set up using exaggerated temperature and time to see what additives or chemicals may be coming from the plastic product that may be transferred to the drug and maybe continue into the human body. The importance and concern for these projects is making sure that appropriate testing protocols are used and whether or not potential harm from chemical exposure may occur. My goals for my future career include working in industry, but prior to my internship, I was unsure about what field of chemistry I wanted to focus on or if I wanted to continue to graduate school. My time at Aspen has allowed me to gain experience in not only a variety of analytical platforms, but also build relationships with coworkers and ask them about their educational and work experience. This has further encouraged me to continue my education and accept an offer from Iowa State University to to obtain a PhD degree in analytical chemistry.
You had me until you said Iowa State.
Oh, cyclone!
We will not. We will not vote on alma maters.
Yes.
Today.
Yes.
You may want to stay in Ames.
Yep.
I apologize for interrupting your testimony. Please.
That's all right. I was definitely unsure about the PhD program before starting my internship, and I wouldn't feel as prepared for graduate school or motivated to continue my education without confidence, skills, and expertise that I gained at Aspen. I believe that my overall experience from working at Aspen will greatly contribute to my graduate education and future success as an analytical chemist. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much. And you said you're from Prior Lake, right?
Prior Lake, Minnesota. Are you,
is this a constituent of yours, Representative Vogel? Or Representative Lunan? Sorry.
That would be in Representative
Albright. Oh, okay. Good. Well, thank you again for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Roger Pearson, and I'm the President of Analytical Services at Aspen Research. So you've heard Kristen talk, and I can tell you it's been just a great pleasure to see this whole program just kind of balloon. Aspen got into it in 2012. And I quite frankly can't tell you how I heard about it because I don't remember, but it may well have been from Becky. Since we got into the program, we've had 10 interns that we've used at Aspen Research, and they're extremely valuable. And when I first started looking at hiring younger people coming into a company that has fairly senior experienced people by the nature of the work we do, it was the old chicken and the egg, you know, what experience have you had? Not very much. How are they going to get it? Well, so I kind of felt like it was part of industry's job to try and afford young people the opportunity to get experiences, to build their resume, and to continue forth. Now, by the nature of what we do, we need science, technology, engineering people. So this program is just wonderful, and quite frankly, I've hired twice as many interns as I probably would have because the program allows us to do that. I believe that we give them a great opportunity to really contribute. They're not coming in and just washing glasses or anything like that. When they go back to either other industries, of our 10 interns we've had, three have secured full-time employment in the state of Minnesota, one full-time employment outside the state of Minnesota, one full-time employment with us at Aspen, another's gone on to a PhD program at Drake, and two others are in graduate schools in Minnesota. So we will hire again this summer at least two, if not four, interns. And it's my hope that you will support this with everything that you can and all the favor, because it's just a wonderful program. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee, Kent Cavender Bears, CEO of Robot Systems. We're a Twin Cities startup. Very early stage out in the market to raise venture capital. My job as a CEO is to make sure there's a positive balance in the bank account. So related to this hearing, the SciTech Experience internship program has been great for that. It allows us to get talent in at a reasonable cost to the company, so that's a great thing. But at a deeper level, I had, I would say, a very bad internship experience as an undergrad, and so I feel it's our responsibility, as the other testifier mentioned, to make good opportunities for people. So I had two interns with us this past summer, both engineering students, and really strove to give them an experience that they couldn't have elsewhere, gave them a very open-ended project. It ended up providing some real great strategic insights for us. Worth mentioning, we're a little bit different animal in that we're building robots to work in cornfields to help farmers make more money while becoming better stewards. So it is a very interesting opportunity. A lot of people want to get into robotics. It's both a challenge to find the right talent, but also it's neat to see a bunch of students that are eager to get such experience.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Lunan, do you have any other invited testifiers?
No, I don't.
Okay. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of our bill and move to member questions and comments. Representative Mahoney.
Representative Lunan, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lunan, does your bill in any way change the wages that are paid or required to pay, because the program back, I think, 2013 or whatever it was when it started, there was specific talk about wages. There was goals. So I've got three questions in this one. Does it change the wages? Does it change the goals for Greater Minnesota, which I believe were 50-50? And does it change anything in the low-income and disadvantaged youth participation, which I believe was like 35-65, for a couple of different reasons? And does it make any of those changes?
To the Representative Lunan or to the testifiers?
Well, I'll start with the it does not affect the wage rate at all. None of that was in there. And I'm going to let them answer the I'm not aware of any changes in any prescribed ratios. If there is, I'll let you articulate that. But I don't think there's a change.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
I'm Becky Siegmeyer. I'm the program director for SciTech Experience. It's not my recollection that we have specific targets for Greater Minnesota, but we have done very well in Greater Minnesota. We do a lot of outreach in those areas. I just got back from St. Cloud this morning. We have right now, well, last year we had, it was about a 60-40 split between Metro versus Greater Minnesota companies, and we're trending that way again this year. About 39% of the internships have some tie to Minnesota, either through the student or through the company. So we're trending well in that area. And I apologize, Representative Mahoney, I don't remember your second question was?
Representative Mahoney.
The low income.
Low income. The program is open to all students, and so it's we do targeted outreach to students of color, different student groups, and we do outreach to women students and students in general. So it's open to all students. We don't pre-screen for that, so I don't necessarily know what their economic status is.
Representative Mahoney, do you know, under current law, do we have those in place? I don't see that language anywhere in the bill, but is that part of the current statute?
Mr. Chair, I think it was stated as goals,
okay, good,
rather than requirements. I have two other questions, or one other question and one other comment. Do the testifiers or the author know the dollar figure that other states put into the programs? I know there are other states that do programs like this, maybe not the same name, but the dollar figure that other states put in.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the last figures that I heard in Nebraska, there's a program called Intern NE, and they funded their program, the last I heard, at $3 million, I believe. I think it was annually, so significantly higher than what we fund our program here. And there's also a program in Ohio. I'm not sure what their funding is. I think it's similar to Nebraska, but they place 600 to 700 students per year as compared to our 100 and some.
One other question or one other comment. Again, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that going off your map here on the metro locations, there's 13 of them are on the west side of the river and only 10 of them are on the east side of the river. But just the I want to be consistent.
Representative Looney. Someone else, Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, as a West Sider, I think it's incumbent upon me to point out that on a per capita basis, you're probably doing very well on the East Side if the ratio is 13
Never
to 10, considering the population ratio.
No. And once again, we witnessed the classic West Side, East Side battle on this committee. Seeing no additional comments, Representative Lunan, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. This program was originally set up to involve and help businesses that weren't large enough to have their own HR department. It's been very successful in that endeavor. And in that, the money that we're giving out has a matching component to it so that they have skin in the game as well. It seems like what's happening on this is that the students are having a strong enough experience that they're going back. Word of mouth is getting out, and that's what's causing the increase in appetite for a situation like this, and it's creating a lot of winners, and I ask for your approval.
With that, Representative Lunan renews his motion to have House File 713 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Lunan, and thank you very much to our testifiers. Representative Kresha.
Thank you.
Representative Crescia moves that, or the chair moves that House File 438 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Crescia, I have a delete all amendment here, A15-0209. My understanding is this is to replace it with the House, with the original language. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion, members? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. Representative Crescia to House File 438 as amended.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And if you'll indulge me for 1 second, I just wanted to find my comments. And I don't have the email in front of me, but that's okay. Oh, there we go. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have before you House File 438. I do have the author's amendment, which we've taken. That takes it back to House File 1 language, which was the original language that we were working on. We've tried to work with a couple of other groups. There were some other bills out there that did the same thing. But ultimately, what we found is going back to a narrower scope seems to be our best approach. And so with that, this act mirrors the federal program and establishes a tax credit program to get private capital investment in operating businesses in underserved communities. The language from HF1 focuses these investments into businesses in the fields of high-tech, manufacturing, mining, and forestry. There have been some misconceptions about what the funds can be used for. This bill makes it clear that the investment can go into owner-occupied real estate. Example, a paper mill may want to invest in new equipment but need to expand their factory to do so. They could use this program to complete the project. Between 2003 and 2012, $31 billion in direct new market tax credit investments were made in businesses that created approximately 750,000 jobs at the cost of the federal government of less than $20,000 per job. And these new market tax credit investments leveraged over $60 billion in total capital investments in businesses located in communities with high rates of poverty and unemployment. By establishing a state new market tax credit program, we can also attract high levels of private investment in our businesses. I do have a testifier here today and would like to speak in support of the bill.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Before we have you state your name for the record, the chair is going to move. Staff has brought to my attention on page 3, line 3.36. I believe that word is supposed to be equity. The second word is qualified equity, not qualified entity investment. Is that the understanding of the testifier as well as the author?
Yes, right. Mr. Chair.
So with that, the chair will move that correction. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Paul Cassidy. I'm with the law firm of Stinson Leonard Street. I represent Enhanced Capital, an investment firm that's been participating in both the federal and state new markets tax credit program over the past several years. The federal new markets tax credit program was established during the Clinton years and enacted by Congress in 2000 in order to direct capital investment into existing operating businesses located in low-income communities. The new markets tax credit program authorizes both individual and corporate investors to receive a tax credit against the federal income tax they pay. This equity is invested by financial institutions called community development entities, or CDEs. CDEs can take the form of a lot of different entities, such as economic development authorities like the St. Paul Port Authority, or a regional economic development authority, or an investment company such as my client as an equity investment firm. This is a highly competitive program. Between 2003 and 2012, $20 billion in private capital was invested at the federal level in communities with high poverty rates, low incomes, and high unemployment rates. It's estimated that the demand in the federal program, New Markets Tax Credit Program alone, far exceeds its funding by a ratio of almost 10 to 1. Because of the high demand for this access to capital at the federal level, 14 other states have chosen to adopt a similar New Markets Tax Credit Program at the state level in order to attract private capital. The proposal before you today would create a state new markets tax program in Minnesota separate and apart from the federal program. This proposal would authorize a new markets tax credit program in Minnesota that would emulate the federal program utilizing much of the same regulatory framework with one twist. Minnesota would not have to compete for a federal allocation. Instead, it would have its own pool of dollars from which to draw from. This new program would authorize $250 million in new capital to be deployed in the first year of enactment. Investors would have access to a tax credit for their investment in the CDE. The CDEs must have an allocation agreement with the U.S. Department of Treasury and a service area that includes Minnesota, and allocation awards would be authorized through deed. All capital deployed within the first year would be in low-income, economically distressed areas. Just like the federal program, the credit totals 39% of the original investment amount and is claimed over a period of 7 years. Beginning in year three, nothing can be claimed the first 2 years, 8% for the third through sixth year, and 7% in the seventh year, totaling $97 million over the seven-year period. This new program would focus on extending an existing business's credit and broadening access to affordable capital. Authorized money must stay in Minnesota's economy for the full 7 years of the program. Investments that are repaid or sold must be redeployed within 1 year in another business operating in an economically distressed community. Unclaimed tax credits are subject to disallowance for the entire seven-year credit compliance period, and the CD is subject to fines in the legislation if any of these rules are violated. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I would stand for questions. A couple of things I'd like to point out, I believe, in your packet are a map of the state of Minnesota which highlights the distressed areas. If any of you are interested in seeing a more granular map of your district, we can provide that to you as well to show the areas that would qualify for this. And finally, if I can show you inside the packet, the diagram that shows you how the money flows through the program on the second page, and also then on the back page how the tax credits are paid out over a seven-year period. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Representative Crescia, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not, Mr.
This
Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to members' questions or comments. Any questions or comments for members of the committee? Representative Crescia, any closing comments?
I do not. Just very briefly, we know access to capital in many of these areas is very difficult, and I think this is a worthwhile endeavor to pursue. So with that, I would appreciate your support, Mr. Chair and members.
With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 438 as amended, recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Lucero.
Singly?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero.
Because you so appropriately shamed me yesterday, wasn't going to make the same mistake twice. So,
Representative Lucero, I have some bad news for you. It's the right action, but the wrong bill. I don't think it's going to change any votes today.
Well, perhaps not. But what I do have for us today is cinnamon chip scones from a company called Great Harvest, which is just down the block, as a matter of fact, on Selby. So, whoever wants to pass them out?
I think you can pass them out, can't you?
Simonson just tear them.
No.
Thank you very much, Representative, sir.
They're important.
You all. Peggy, do you want to move the bill?
Oh.
Representative Scott.
I would like to move House. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1400.
Now, Representative Scott moves that House File 1400 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I come from a district in which a Monticello nuclear power plant is right next door. And we appreciate the safety of the plant as it has become a part of our normal daily lives. The Xcel Energy Monticello Nuclear Power Plant was built in 1970. The Prairie Island Nuclear Power Plant was built in 1974. So both plants are 40 to 45 years old at this point. The current permit for both plants expires in the early 2030s, approximately 15 years from now. And my understanding is that the regulatory review process for a new permit takes approximately 15 years. So hence, this discussion is definitely very timely. Minnesota enacted a moratorium on new nuclear power plants in 1994. And the reason I'm bringing this bill forward is I believe that all options should be on the table when considering the future of Minnesota's energy needs. Removing the moratorium would simply allow utilities to at least consider the option. And, Mr. Chair, I do have five testifiers. And I would like to bring the first one up, Bill Heenley from International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
And I have Mr. Melander is on deck, so if he's still here. Okay. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Heenley, Legislative and Political Director for IBEW Minnesota State Council. We represent the workers that run the nuclear plants in the state of Minnesota. We are urging you to repeal this law to pass the bill because we basically think it's kind of a meaningless law for a few reasons. First of all, no utility has on its book a need for a capacity of the size that would come from a plant of this nature. Secondly, the economics for nuclear plants at this point in time are not in line for being a competitive addition to Minnesota electrical generation needs. And thirdly, the permanent management of the spent fuel is not dealt with at this time yet either. If a utility needed capacity of this size that a nuclear plant would bring, and if the economics were in line, and if the spent fuel was dealt with on a permanent basis, all those three things, those stars aligned, I think this moratorium would fly off the books in a blink of an eye. But those, none of those stars are aligned at this point. If you're going to vote for this bill thinking it's going to provide jobs, building trade jobs, I would urge you to think again about that. I think it'll provide some jobs for lawyers, but certainly not building trades people, simply because there's no plans to build a plant of this size. The law as it stands does not prevent anybody from talking about it, thinking about it, and certainly doesn't prevent a utility from considering it. If, like I said, all those stars were aligned and the utility were to sit down with its planners and say, hey, let's see what kind of a new plant we should build because we need this great addition to our capacity here, they would be subject to serious shareholder lawsuits if they didn't consider a nuclear plant. And again, if they considered it and all the stars were aligned, then I think it would be a go. But that's where it's at today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Melander and Mr. Gerber's on deck.
No, I think you jumped ahead. I'm Haney. Melander's on
deck. No, I know you're done, though. I'm calling for Mr. Mr. Melander's testifying next. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Chair, committee members, excuse me, my name is Harry Melander. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council. Our organization represents 60,000 workers within the construction industry. As I like to say every time I get an opportunity, thank you for putting our industry back on track. I'm here today. My comments will be much briefer than they were across the street. Part of my testimony over there was more personally based, so mine are going to be very direct in regards to just creating options for a discussion for baseload energy within the state of Minnesota. We believe in 2015, we're able to have a conversation not only about nuclear energy but other difficult things that face the state of Minnesota, and we would encourage all of you to allow us that opportunity to at least have those types of conversations in baseload energy options. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gerber and then Mr. Evans, you're on deck.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'd like to thank Representative Lucero for bringing this bill forward. I'd like to start out first by stating that the Chamber has had a longstanding policy in repealing the nuclear power moratorium. I think one of the reasons why it's important is that utilities are required by through the integrative resource planning process to plan out 15 years. You look at 15 years ago, we wouldn't have thought that prices for certain energy technologies would have dropped so significantly. And that's why it's also important that we allow for utilities to plan all these different contingencies and include nuclear in their long-term planning. The next is the storage is extremely safe. I hope if you haven't already, you get a chance to go out and see some of these facilities having the ability. Obviously, they're very secure, and that's good. But if you do get the clearance to go, it's pretty amazing to see the safety procedures as well as the security around the facilities. And I think it's important to realize, too, that the way our Public Utilities Commission process works is the lowest cost resource to meet the specific need will get selected. And we are going through a period of time where I just looked up MISO's coal retirement plans. They're going to likely retire 14 or more gigawatts of baseload coal in the coming years, and that will need to be replaced with something. And that something will likely either be natural gas or potentially, if this is removed, could be nuclear. So I think it's important for the planning, and obviously cost is a concern, and the chamber looks at that very closely, and we'd like to work with utilities to at least study this. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. Next, we have Mr. Evans and then Mr. Makala. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. I just really can reiterate what others have said. We're looking forward at a challenging time in the utility industry as we start to encounter things like a carbon-constrained universe and the need to replace aging infrastructure. And as some of our plants start to approach within the planning horizon, which is 15 or 20 years, the end of their useful life. And so we need to start thinking about those things. And I'll just use the cliche that others have used, is it's good to have all the tools in the toolbox. It's certainly true, as some of the other witnesses have said, that as we look at it now, the construction of a nuclear plant seems to be very expensive and possibly outside of what the Public Utilities Commission and the utility might choose as a resource plan, but things happen to change very rapidly. Technology changes around us all the time, and our belief is that this is a good bill to put all those tools back in the toolbox, keeping in mind that, of course, the Public Utilities Commission is the ultimate decision maker as to what resources are chosen as we go forward as a public utility. So this is not a decision that would be left to private entities or certainly to Xcel Energy, but would be part of a statewide process determining the best way to go forward with our energy resources.
Thank you. Mr. Evans, just a quick question. What are the current licenses for Monticello and Prairie Island? When do those currently expire?
There's a question I should know the answer to. we just renewed the 20-year licenses. Just for some of the members of the committee that are new, the original license on the nuclear plants were for 40 years. Those expired a couple of years ago, and we were able to renew those licenses for 20 years, which is the standard renewal. There is no prohibition in law against renewing them for an additional 20 years, but it happens in the United States because of the age of our nuclear fleet. No one's ever done it, so it would be charting new territory. Having stalled to answer your question, I will say that I think it's something like 2023, 2024. That's not right. That's longer than that.
I think we're going to go to the answer validation
senator. Go to Mr. Glahn over there. He seems to have
I think we're going to go to the answer validation senator, and that is Mr. Eloff. Mr. Eloff, do you know what the numbers are? And Mr. Glahn can confirm it if he wants.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that the Monticello license will expire in 2030, and the two units in Prairie Island are 2033 and 2034.
That sounds right, Mr. Chairman.
It does. Okay. And again, but there is a possibility that they may be, at that point, they may be extended in the future. We don't have a reference point for other facilities across the nation that have been extended a third time for their license. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Evans. Mr. Bacala and then Commissioner Grant. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Nathan Makla, and I'm a state government relations manager for the Heartland Institute in Chicago, Illinois. For nearly two decades, Heartland has studied economic and environmental impacts of nuclear power. Today, my testimony is going to explain why it's environmentally beneficial, why nuclear power is safe, and why lifting the prohibition of new nuclear facilities outweighs any cost. My first point is that nuclear power is environmentally beneficial. Nuclear power is America's largest source of clean air, carbon-free electricity, which produces no air pollutants or greenhouse gas emissions. Beyond air quality, nuclear power can produce a vast amount of power from a tiny volume of fuel and requires far less land use than other green energy sources such as wind. An average nuclear power plant occupies one-third of 1 square mile, whereas wind farms must use up to 200 square miles of land to generate the same amount of power. In Minnesota, nuclear plants currently produce 21% of Minnesota's electricity and 56% of Minnesota's emission-free electricity, thus preventing the emissions of tens of thousands of air pollutants. Compact baseload nuclear plants are a direct substitute for baseload coal plants. As a result, opposing nuclear energy has been increased use of coal. It would be prudent for those who oppose nuclear energy to consider the consequences of this position. Legislation for action on climate change and against nuclear energy are incompatible goals. My second point is that nuclear power is one of the safest energy options. Nuclear power plants in the United States are held to the strictest regulatory standards in the world. The nuclear power plants are subject to rigorous Nuclear Regulatory Commission oversight, NRC, including inspections, preventative and corrective maintenance, and extensive equipment testing. The NRC is also required to report to Congress the number of abnormal occurrences that take place at nuclear power plants. Beyond the NRC oversight, the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations keeps a database of operational issues in the nuclear power industry. According to this database, not a single safety significant event has occurred since 2002 in the United States. The Heartland Institute Science Director, Dr. Jay Lehr, has stated that nuclear is the safest form of energy. The nuclear industry has ramped up its safety efforts in recent years. It has developed a diverse, flexible mitigation approach to address the risk of loss of power and maintaining effective cooling. More than $2 billion of safety enhancements have been implemented since 2011. And it should be noted that for half a century, there have been no radiation-related health effects linked to nuclear power facilities. The National Cancer Institute asserts that nuclear power plants effectively protect the public's health. Nuclear waste storage is no longer a safety concern. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission voted 3 weeks ago to lift a moratorium issuing plant licenses after finding that storing spent nuclear fuel rods on site at nuclear plants is completely safe. The commission also voted to adopt a new rule reiterating that spent fuel rods can be stored at closed nuclear plants for long periods of time. Minnesota nuclear plants will be regulated by the same federal agency other nuclear plants around the nation are regulated by, meaning if you trust the federal government on issues like TSCA reform, Ozone Next, the Clean Air Act, then you certainly must trust the NRC to keep Minnesota safe. My third point is that there's economic benefits of nuclear power in the state of Minnesota. Nuclear power is not an intermittent energy source, which makes it more reliable and renewable energy. Nuclear power produces electricity when needed, regardless if the sun is shining or the wind is blowing. Most plants have an 18 to 24-month supply of uranium fuel in their reactors. This allows for grid stability, which provides consumers stable and affordable electricity cost. Nuclear power employs more than 1,300 high-skill workers in Minnesota. Over $315 million of materials, services, and fuel for the nuclear plants are purchased annually for more than 1,150 Minnesota companies. The average payroll for a nuclear power plant, 550 workers, is $40 million and contributes $470 million to the local economy. Chairman and members of this committee, I encourage you to separate facts from unproven fears that are often brought up when talking about nuclear power. Ultimately, government should enact those regulations that are necessary, only those regulations that are necessary to protect the health and the public health and the environment. Nuclear benefits both the environment and its public health. In conclusion, the expansion of nuclear power in this state would be beneficial to the environment. The industry has a proven track record of safety, and the new construction of these plants would provide significant economic benefits to your state. Therefore, Minnesota should lift its moratorium on the construction of new nuclear plants. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you very much for your testimony, sir. Commissioner Grant. That means you're done. Thank you. Commissioner Grant, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the members. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. And I wish I'd had the opportunity to go right after Mr. Haney from the IBEW, because for all the reasons he supports this legislation, we would oppose it. And I think there are many strong reasons to keep Minnesota's nuclear moratorium in place. First, as he mentioned, new nuclear power plants have yet to find a solution for their waste. And the high cost of development of a waste solution would be paid by ratepayers. Instead, we continue to demand a national solution to the nuclear waste dilemmas at both Monticello and Prairie Island. Otherwise, these two communities in Minnesota may become permanent repositories for nuclear waste. Second point is around the need for such a facility, and it's clear now that Minnesota does not need new nuclear power plants into the foreseeable future. According to the plans submitted by our utilities to the Public Utilities Commission, Minnesota does not need to build new baseload power for at least the next 15 years. The last nuclear power plants in Minnesota began operating in 1973. The last coal-fired power plant was commissioned in 1987. In the meantime, Minnesota electric utilities have responded to increasing electricity demand with a diversified mix of lower cost and environmentally preferable resources, such as wind and facilities that burn natural gas and biomass fuel. The third point, Mr. Chair, is the cost issue. And costs continue to be the major sticking point for new nuclear power plant construction in this country. And many of the reasons stem from the problems that nuclear power plants have had in this country and elsewhere. The plant disaster in Japan, for example, have driven the cost of building and operating new nuclear plants ever higher. And for consumers, the rate impacts, particularly to struggling businesses facing global competition and low-income Minnesotans already paying a disproportionate share of their income for energy, would be unacceptably severe. So, Mr. Chair, the Department of Commerce is committed to working on Minnesota's energy future with the legislature, Minnesota's electric utilities, and stakeholders to determine how we can best meet our statewide energy needs and strengthen our economy without exposing ourselves to the higher costs and risks of nuclear power. I'd be happy to take any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. In your testimony, you said we don't need new generation for the foreseeable future. Are you using 15 years as the foreseeable future?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, I said we don't need a new baseload capacity for the next 15 years. That's right, according to the plans that have been submitted to the PUC.
So, Commissioner, if Monticello and Prairie Island drop offline, what baseload power sources are acceptable to the Dayton administration?
Mr. Chair, a number of our utilities have existing contracts with power plants in hydroelectric dams in Manitoba. Those are something that we would expect will continue to develop as dam capacity increases in Manitoba. And, of course, we still receive the largest share of our power from coal-fired power plants. It has been mentioned that some of those will retire as they age, particularly the smaller, older facilities, and some of that has already started to happen. But we do expect the two major baseload units in the state to continue operating for some time.
But Commissioner Grant, in terms of replacing this power, we can't build new coal-fired power plants. So how do we replace that power?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't believe there's a prohibition on building new coal-fired power plants. There is going to be a requirement that they meet certain emission standards, and that is going to require carbon capture and storage technology, a technology that is still under development and may be available by the time new facilities will be needed.
It's a generous statement, but yeah, the technology doesn't exist today to build a coal-fired power plant that would be allowed under federal rules, right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct, but I think a new nuclear plant is going to have the same kind of difficult sledding for its own reasons.
No, but at least the technology exists. It's not a theory. We know that we can do that. The carbon sequestration technology that, for example, is being used in the Kemper facility in Mississippi, the primary reason why they're able to do that is because they're doing oil recovery, which unless there's something new, unless we find some sort of oil recovery in Minnesota, I don't think we're going to be able to use that.
Mr. Chair, in addition to the facilities in this country, though, and there's one in Beulah, North Dakota, selling CO2 to Canada for enhanced oil recovery as well, There are facilities in Europe that are currently operating with carbon capture and storage technology.
But doesn't our, isn't the Next Generation Act, doesn't it prohibit, isn't there some element of prohibiting it unless, is there a requirement for a carbon offset?
Mr. Chair, there's a requirement that it meet a certain emission standard that a carbon capture ready plant would be able to meet.
Okay, so hydro, a yet undetermined technology for carbon sequestration for coal, what other baseload sources will be available?
Well, Mr. Chair, natural gas can certainly be operated as a baseload facility, although it typically is not.
Okay. And the I guess the concern I have is that right now we are on a regulatory pathway for various reasons, not just regulatory, but also just the economics, that the only new generation we're building in this country primarily is natural gas and renewables. And what that does is it eliminates one of the principal tenets of energy policy, which is reliability. We are we're removing diversification from our energy mix. And I'm a huge proponent of natural gas. It's great for America. It's great for the environment. But what I'm against is an energy grid that is 100% natural gas and renewables and nothing else. I'm opposed to that. And I've heard the governor's comments on coal, that he wants Minnesota to be coal-free. I've seen those comments echoed in a letter from the MPCA. And so it's very concerning to me from a stability and diversification standpoint that there should be other things besides natural gas and renewables. And your comments excluded today, I've heard a lot of hostility to coal regardless of how it's done. The technology doesn't exist. I certainly understand natural gas can do that. Hydro isn't even classed. The hydro facilities in Canada, the big one is really gonna, hasn't even developed yet. It's the one of them's under construction. Do you understand the concerns I have about diversification?
Mr. Chair, I do, and I would say if you look at the current energy mix in Minnesota, adding natural gas and renewables is actually restoring diversity to our energy mix rather than ruining it. We still rely predominantly on coal and nuclear in this state, and will for the foreseeable future. As I see it, adding natural gas and renewables is actually growing our diversity, not lessening it.
And Commissioner, I would agree with you that in the short term, that is correct. But I also see the regulatory environment we're in with regards to coal. I hear the governor say he wants Minnesota to be coal-free. I see a moratorium on new nuclear, and I see huge amounts of power generation that are going to be, at least under current licensing, are expiring in 2030, 2033, and 2034. It sets up an environment where, in a very swift manner, we can be very dependent on natural gas and just renewables. And that's the pathway that we are on, absent any changes in Minnesota public policy. And you slap on the 111D stuff, and that's kind of where it is. So thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate you answering those questions. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Come on down, Mr. Hottinger. Are there any other testifiers besides Mr. Hottinger? All right, Mr. Hottinger, you'll be our last testifier. Then we'll close the public comment portion, and we'll move to member questions. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. John Hottinger. I'm here representing the Sierra Club. And I'm kind of like Commissioner Grant. Mr. Haney may have well said it all, but I will add a much reduced set of comments. The Sierra Club, as you know, is the largest grassroots voice to preserve and protect Minnesota's environment with 14,000 people. We have consistently been opposed to nuclear power. Much of the reasons still exist. The storage of radioactive waste, the potential costs of nuclear power, and that's, I guess, one of the things I've heard here is that nuclear power is becoming increasingly non-competitive, especially since the disaster in Japan and the $300 billion expense of what took place at Chernobyl some time ago. And because the waste product is so expensive to maintain and to watch over, and it's so expensive to build new plants. No one got up here and said, gee, I think we're going to build a new nuclear power plant. And you can take that both ways. Why do we need this if nobody's going to do it anyway? But I think we're better off recognizing that if it is, and Mr. Haney spoke to this, if someone actually thinks that it is economically wise for their shareholders or for anyone else to build a nuclear power plant, then they'll be here and they'll present us a suggestion that says, hey, we can prove it's safe. We can prove it's economically viable. Right now, for instance, the changes at Monticello ended up costing ratepayers a lot of money to upgrade the place. And the numbers that most impacted me, and I'm going to keep this real brief, but the cost of decommissioning a nuclear power plant once they've outlived their useful life. You don't turn off the lights and walk away. According to a December report from Xcel on decommissioning its Minnesota plants, shipping of the spent fuel would have to wait a minimum of 30 years due to a need to cool the spent fuel following discharge from the reactor. The projection of costs of decommissioning run the gamut from 36 years requiring a cost of $1.1 billion to 100 years after shutdown at $2.1 billion. Unless we can solve these problems, we're not going to see nuclear power, much less need it. I found interesting Mr. Gerber's comments, who said, how do we replace it in the future? Well, Mr. Chairman, you had a much better discussion about that. Mr. Gerber said natural gas or nuclear. But your comments, which are forthright and look forward to a discussion that needs to be had, include the reality of renewables and the expansion of renewables, and also, that no one's mentioned, efficiency. One of the things that has been, at least on the demand side of the electrical equation and the power equation, has been efficiency. If we can expand that to industrial efficiency, look at the supply side, and we've got some gains to be made there. But that full equation isn't clear at this point, and it deserves discussion. But until we know that there's a safe way to do nuclear power and one that's market viable, to deal with this moratorium and eliminate it is unnecessary. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to appear.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Once again, are there any additional members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of our bill and move to member comments and questions. First of all, Representative Fortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions start for Mr. Evans from Xcel.
Representative Fortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, in the company's proposed integrated resource plans, are you proposing a new nuclear plant?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members, no.
Representative Horton.
Are you familiar with the Georgia plant that's been under construction for the past few years?
Representative Evans.
Mr. Chair, members, I know it exists. That's probably the limit of my knowledge about it.
Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are you familiar with how far behind they are, how much over budget they are in Georgia?
Mr. Evans. Representative Evans.
That's
Mr.
Right.
Evans.
I know who you mean. Mr. Chair, members, you know, I don't know the specifics of it, but I know what you're talking about. I mean, they are behind schedule, and the costs are over initial estimates.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, when we took the tour of the Prairie Island Nuclear Plant, do you remember the one thing that the plant operators wouldn't, the one question they would not answer?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members, no, I don't.
Representative Hartman.
Representative Groffel, I can't remember if you were there with me at the time when we toured the plant, but there were some nice young men walking around with machine guns strapped to the front of their bodies and all other types of weaponry attached to their shins. And I said, so how many guys like that are walking around on the site? And they said, that's the one question we can't answer. Mr. Evans, I was wondering, how much does Xcel pay to have the retired Navy SEALs try to breach the security at Prairie Island every year?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know all of the details of the operations of the nuclear plant. What I can tell you is that all of those costs are considered by the Public Utilities Commission in their function of determining whether plants should be operating or should be replaced, and all of those resource planning and certificate of need questions. So while I don't know the details of any of those costs, there is a public body in the state of Minnesota that does examine those costs as a part of the their function of approving or not approving plans.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Evans, thank you. I just think as policymakers, the reason I'm asking you these questions, one thing I'm being nice to Representative Lucero and not asking Representative Lucero these questions that he should know the answer to, but I'm sure he does. I think is likely he does not, and you may.
I barely do. So.
But as members of this committee, if we were to vote in favor of a potential future bill that would have this provision in it, I think we would need the answers to those questions. How many armed guards do you have at Sherco or any of the wind facilities that you own?
Mr. Evans.
Well, you've already been told that was the one question we can't answer, so.
Representative Hartman.
I have the additional excuse that I don't know.
Nicely done, nicely done. Well, I'm going to hazard a guess that you don't have a nice young man walking around with automatic weapons at your coal and your, perhaps Representative Neuberger knows if there are any armed guards at Sherco.
So, Representative Neuberger.
Representative Hartman, you could probably consider most of the residents of Sherman County as the armed guard.
Okay.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, for how long will the waste on the Prairie Island site be stored there?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is undetermined at this point.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My next question, well, let me ask Mr. Evans this question, but then I have the same question for Representative Lucero, Mr. Haney, and Mr. Malander, and that is, do you think a deal is a deal? When somebody makes a commitment to somebody as part of a deal, should that person live up to the commitment that they've made?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that sounds like a trick question, so I guess it depends on the deal.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, members, I think what members of the committee should know is that in 1994, Xcel sought permission to store nuclear waste on the Mississippi River banks near the Prairie Island community. And the deal that was made at that time to allow the storage was that this language would go into Minnesota law. And so I think that out of respect for the commitment that the company made in 1994 to resolve one of the most contentious issues that ever went through the Minnesota legislature, that the deal should be honored. Nuclear is not cost-effective. It is not safe. The chair and I could not, as members of the LEC, go visit the nuclear storage site in Carlsbad, New Mexico, because there was a radiation leak. So the LEC couldn't go look at the proposed secure waste storage site because it was not safe to do so. Representative Lucero, where do you propose to store any new waste from any proposed new nuclear facility?
Representative Lucero.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would defer to the experts on that, but my understanding is that technology continues to evolve, and there are new methods continuously coming out. So, but again, I would defer to the experts on that one.
And Representative Hartman, just 2 points of factual correction for you. I mean, one, the Carlsbad, I've toured the Carlsbad facility before you and I were, and others were going to go there. It wasn't shut down because it was unsafe. It was because they didn't know what had caused. They were picking up levels of radioactivity and they wanted to make sure where it was. There was never any exposure to the public. There was never any public danger. It is a permanent nuclear repository that has safely transported tons of nuclear low-level nuclear waste across this country with a 100% safety record. And if there's one facility that people should get a chance to visit if they're interested in energy issues, it is to visit the Carlsbad facility. It is literally in the middle of nowhere. There's no water underground, stable geological formation. It is a permanent repository and one where they actually support the permanent storage of low-level radioactive waste. With regards to the issue of where future storage is going to go, I think it's generally recognized that in the short term here, Yucca Mountain's going to open back up. Now that Harry Reid's no longer majority leader, it doesn't take a fair amount of controversy to recognize that's where things are going, and that we'll be moving beyond that to regional repositories. But in terms of where that's going to be and where it's going to happen, I don't know. But I'll tell you this, the science is indisputable that having a permanent repository is far safer than the decentralized distributed mechanism that we currently have under law. Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, if Carlsbad was safe, we would have gone to see it. It's not safe. They're not letting people in right now. So
it's not a matter of safety, Representative Hortman. It's that they didn't know what it was. So Representative Hortman, go ahead. Semantics.
Well, I share their concern in not letting people go in where they're not sure where the radioactivity is coming from. So I think that's probably a wise decision by the people who operate the site. Representative Lucero, are you aware that the only utilities in the United States of America who are proposing or building nuclear are utilities who can shift the risk to ratepayers and that shareholders don't have to bear the risk?
Representative Lucero.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hortman, no, I was not aware of that.
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, do you know by what percentage the Monticello repairs were over budget?
Mr. Evans, do you know what that number is for how much the upgrade and enhancements and repairs to Monticello were?
Mr. Chair, you're protecting the freshman from hazing.
Oh, no. I just don't think he knows the answer.
Well, I'll defer to Representative Portman, who probably knows the answer.
Representative Portman, do you know the answer?
Even more accurately than
I do know the answer. Well, I don't know the answer. I know that the proposed upgrade was initially 300 and some million. I believe it was around 320 million. And I know that the completed upgrade cost $748 million.
So, Representative Hortman, I have given you 14 questions for the testifiers. Is it okay if I move on to other members' questions now?
Mr. Chair, I think that that's entirely appropriate, but I would say that it would be respectful to the committee if in the future when you prevent us from asking questions of each of the testifiers as they come up that you hold yourself to the same standard.
I might do that, but again, I've given you 14 questions, Representative Hortman. If you want to ask more, you can go ahead. But if
no, I'm
you
good, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I just want to make sure. Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
And you're not going to get 14 questions, Representative Fabian, just so no. Representative Fabian.
Mr. Grant, will you come down, please? Is there anybody here from Minnesota Power? Mr. Chair? Thank you. Mr. Grant, you talked about the Manitoba Hydro situation. What do you know about, well, I won't ask that question. Currently, Minnesota Power is proposing a transmission line that's coming down, obviously, from Manitoba. Are you aware of the controversy, regarding the siting of the power line that's coming across the Canadian border into Minnesota? And the administration's desire to change the siting to add cost to the line?
Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, the only controversy I'm aware of is the proposed crossing point from Canada into the United States.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's not a controversy at this time. I believe Minnesota can say that, Power can say that that has been solved, and it was solved with a lot of work by a lot of people in the local area doing that. The siting situation now has to do with where the power line is going to run. Is it going to go across state land or is it going to go across private land? Are you familiar with that? And the administration's Grant. Position on that?
Mr. Chair, the function we perform for the Public Utilities Commission in siting processes is to evaluate routes and compare the environmental impacts associated with those routes. I'm not aware of a controversy surrounding the crossing of state lands versus private lands.
Thank you.
Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would adding miles to a siting add cost to a project, Mr. Grant?
Commissioner Grant.
Chair and Representative Fabian, that would depend on a number of factors involving the type of property and land that was being crossed, whether that property would need to be taken through eminent domain or not.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If there were increased costs, would those costs be borne by the ratepayers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, likely they would, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can someone from Minnesota Power help me with the next question? As I understand it, the hydroelectric dam that's being constructed is located, I believe, east of Lake Winnipeg. And rather than the transmission line coming straight south east of Lake Winnipeg, it's actually going to be routed west of Lake Winnipeg and Lake Manitoba. Are you familiar with that, sir?
first of all, if you could introduce yourself for the sake
of
that we know.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Thor Underdahl with Minnesota Power. Representative Fabian, I'm not 100% familiar with that. I could talk with our siting and permitting folks and the folks working on that line in the regulatory manner.
Thank Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just a little latitude here. I am familiar with that. I've seen the siting and so forth, and it's going literally hundreds of miles west at higher costs, and they're going to be borne by the ratepayers. My point is that I hear so many people expressing concern about ratepayers, but because of siting and issues that associated with them that I think could be solved, we add costs that the ratepayers are picking up. So I get concerned that some of the issues that come forward with regards to the siting on state land versus public land, we had a deal pretty much worked out. Representative talked about a deal should be a deal, and we thought that we had one worked out, and now the administration is coming in kind of near the end and saying that we don't have a deal. So that becomes a concern of mine. If I could ask Mr. Hottinger a couple of questions, or should I defer my time, Mr. Chair?
If you could just do it quickly. Mr. Hottinger, if you could come down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Hottinger. I appreciate your desire to protect ratepayers. You talked about the increased costs to the XL project at Monticello and the cost to ratepayers. Can you tell me how much the ratepayers had their monthly increases go up by?
Mr. Hottinger, I'll say Representative Fabian. I don't know if that's... Those have not been billed to customers yet. So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. And just a partial response, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, I got my hair cut. Thank you for the recommendation. As I understand, the overrun, and Representative Portman alluded to that, was $402 million. And of that cost overrun, Xcel is picking up $71 million. And the ratepayers are therefore picking up about $330 million. That's the information I have.
So one more question, Representative Fabian, then we're going to go to Representative Isaacson.
And to that point, in western North Dakota, in the coal-fired plants, the upgrades that have been made there to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, who's picking up the cost on those?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, I do not have that information. I suspect, as with Representative Fortman, you do.
It's the ratepayers.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I have a couple of questions here, but I want to make sure I frame them correctly. You know, inherently I'm not just against nuclear power for the sake of being against nuclear power. It actually is a very clear issue to me, and that is all the science that I've read about it just doesn't have a conclusive way to manage the long-term effects of the spent fuel, right? And we have some short-term ways of saving it, but even our best short-term waves of saving it, future generations will be paying the price unless technology catches up. And so what I don't understand, when I hear the tension and talking about how we're going to find different ways of managing future needs in the energy grid, and Representative Garofalo, you had talked about the lack of diversification that we have. My question is, it seems to me like we're conflating several issues in a kind of a misdirection rather than talking about what the main issue is, which is nuclear power a good idea to bring back on the table as a possibility, right? And it seems like it's really clear that it's not until we have the technology to manage the waste. And so I want to make it that simple. And do you agree with that statement or not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Isaacson, no, I believe that we should have the discussion. We should not stomp on the ability to even have a conversation.
Well, we're having
removing the moratorium would not change anything other than allow us to have the conversation.
Representative Isaacson.
It appears to me that we're having the conversation right now and the moratorium's still in place. So I think that's, and I appreciate you bringing the bill because I think you're right to have the conversation. My concern is that, you know, we're not talking about a train derails and it's horrible for families and a town gets affected and it's awful, and 10 years later the town can kind of recover in some respects. And other things can happen in different energy circles that can be horrible, but when a nuclear thing happens, right, when we have problems there, it's like generational. When you have fuel that's going to last tens of thousands over a million years, right, we can't foresee that. It's not fathomable to us to think of it in terms of that many generations. But my concern is that if we don't start thinking like that, that's kind of what got us in this pickle in the first place environmentally. While I'm sympathetic to the concerns we have about making sure we're moving at a gradual rate that doesn't ruin business and stick ratepayers with a lot of money, in terms of how much they have to pay, it is my concern that at the same time, if we're not being environmentally responsible, it kind of makes the point moot. Right, and so when I look at this idea of bringing nuclear power back, it is kind of mind-boggling to me when the science is so clear that long-term we just don't know how to manage it. Just don't know how to manage it. It isn't like an and maybe, but we don't have the best facility we've built can last 10,000 years, it says. The rods are going to be radioactive for a million years. Now, I know that to us it doesn't seem like much because we're around for maybe 100 years if we're lucky. But I want to be thinking about future generations and the way that I manage our energy. And I think that the argument being made that, well, technology is going to catch up with nuclear energy, well, guess what? Technology is going to catch up with solar. It's going to catch up with wind. It's going to catch up with hydro as well and push us forward. So I just can't believe that this is a relevant discussion to be had right now in the sense that there are so many other options on the table and we are so unclear about the long-term future of nuclear power. Why we'd be having this discussion when there are so many other discussions to be had is kind of beyond me.
Representative Isaacson, do you know how we dispose of the spent nuclear fuel from nuclear submarines and nuclear aircraft carriers?
I do not.
Do you believe that we safely do it right now?
I would be surprised to think that, yes. I do not. I don't think that we do long-term have an answer for that stuff. But I'm not a nuclear engineer either.
Just, it's important because there were a lot of statements made about permanent storage of spent fuel. Mm-hmm. You should know that for decades, the United States has safely transported and stored permanent repositories of spent nuclear fuel from our nuclear submarine fleet as well as nuclear aircraft.
To Yucca Mountain or to where?
No, I mean, it's through the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. The primary.
So we don't have access to that, I suppose.
No, so it's primarily through the state of Idaho. Mm-hmm. It travels our interstate highway system.
Sure.
It travels our rail system.
Yep.
And so we are doing this right now. And the objections to this, and the reason why I bring this up is not science, because your objections to this were on science, and I will tell you, the science is clear. Mm-hmm. The science is clear that right now we safely transport and store spent nuclear fuel from the Department of Defense. The difference is because of the Department of Defense, they don't have the level of state civilian oversight that we do with our energy policies. Representative
Mr. Garofalo, I would say that you're correct almost completely, except that right now, so far, they have safely done that as far as we know.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the members of the committee. I actually have been, you know, they wouldn't let me touch the dry cast storage down at Prior Island, but I stood in front of it. I actually worked around it for a little while. I spent 2 years working there. Just so everyone understands, my radiation level after 2 years at Prior Island was less than a chest x-ray. And that's going through there. I can't remember what they call it, but it is a safe facility. The fact that they have armed guards is a terrorist issue. And, you know, people bring up the red herring about the federal government having to subsidize the insurance for nuclear power plants. Well, we subsidize all of America because of terrorist attacks. Almost every large building, every insurance company, every big facility, every oil refinery, every chemical plant, we as a federal, our federal government subsidizes that particular piece of insurance. And if they didn't, many pieces of the state of this country would shut down. I have a couple of questions, and I'll try to be, not questions, but a couple of statements, that and I'll try to be quick. They talk about the Manitoba hydropower. I'm a bit concerned because I do remember the issue with the Native American, Native Canadian, or first citizens of Canada, and their problem with hydro. So, you know, are we just having another country deal with a problem so that we don't have to? That's a question that I have. We have right now, to use a phrase that one of my colleagues uses, we have a storage facility not 500 feet from an Indian child care center. That's truly unacceptable. We have to deal with that. We have to get rid of that dry cask storage that is stored at Prairie Island, and whether it's at Yucca Mountain or wherever, but that's unacceptable. But having said that, oh, and then the one other thing about people saying, talking about Chernobyl, well, if you look at Russian technology and Russian technicians, and Vada, Mr. Putin might be a little upset at me, but they were incompetent, and their designs were incompetent. The Japanese fiasco was because they didn't put a roof and a second generation generator on plant site. A complete human failure of planning, of engineers, not the actual plant itself. It was designed to be fixed. And in today's world, as they design these plants, you have a non-mechanical way of shutting the plant down. You don't need a generator. The plant comes to a certain point, the bells and whistles go off, the valves open up on top, and they fill the can. So, members, I have always supported lifting this ban for the simple fact that it is a 15 to 30 year process, and neither you nor I nor anyone in this room or in this state actually knows what we're going to be facing in 30 years. And fear should not dictate our decisions. So there, I've said all my piece. I'm going to support this bill moving forward, so long as someone tells me that they're going to move some casks from Prairie Island.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Members, we have another committee hearing that's going to be coming in here. We have three additional members on the list. What we're going to do is, should this bill show up in a later bill, then we'll resume this conversation at that time. Representative Lucero, do you have any closing comments?
The only closing comment I would have is I want to make sure that this was distributed. It's a letter of support from the Minnesota utility investors.
We did receive that.
Thank you.
And with that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 14 over laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Lucero, thank you, and thank you for the treats. Members, thank you again for members' brief questions and comments last night as well as today. It is greatly appreciated. With that, we are adjourned.